morning. Thank you all for coming so early on a Sunday morning. Welcome to one of the last events of Bristol Crime Fest. I'm Peter Guthridge, as you can see, and I'm really pleased to be hosting this event where we're looking at the future of crime fiction. I know those of you who are writing, who are in the audience, will be hoping you've still got a future in crime fiction, but these are the new generation of crime fiction writers. And what's interesting about this particular panel is that they cover a wide range of the genre, and it shows just how wide a range the genre does cover. I'm going to let them introduce themselves. I'm going to be then prodding them with a few questions, then you'll have an ample chance to ask some questions, and then I hope you'll be buying many copies of their books in the signing room. Please welcome our guests. So let's start at the far end. Alison, introduce yourself.
Yeah. Good morning. My name's Alison Bruce. I've just had my first novel out. It's called Cambridge Blue. I've been writing, like I expect most people here, quite a few years before I got to the point of having a first book published. I write fiction and non-fiction, but Cambridge Blue is a series set in Cambridge featuring the youngest detective in Cambridge's Parkside Station, Gary Couture, and that's it really.
Okay, thank you Alison, welcome. Steve, explain yourself, man.
Not again. I'm Steve Haig. I'm from Norwich, born and raised, and my first novel is called Justice for All, which came out last year. It's a US-based crime thriller, so I made things slightly interesting for myself by setting my book overseas. I got into it very much through a love of US crime writing in general, which is why I've gone down that route, and it's about an ex-cop who's still wanting to pursue justice outside the law. He's driven to do so from a number of demons in his background. And the follow-up to it is coming out next year as well. It's a series, sorry, this year, series character, Zack Hunter. And again, that's about it, I guess, at this point.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Matthew, explain yourself.
Hi, I'm Matthew Hall. My first book came out in January. It's called The Coroner. My background is that I've been a television screenwriter for 10 years, and I'd always wanted to write books, so I had a crack at it a couple of years ago. My main character is called Jenny Cooper. She is a coroner, and she works in Bristol. The Coroner is the first of a series, and the second book is coming out next January.
Okay, thank you, Matthew. Ali?
Right, I'm Ali Munro, and my first book, called The Maze of Cadiz, came out in November. And it's going to be the first of a series which follows... I also have a young protagonist, a little bit like Alison. He's 25 years old, a Cambridge graduate of economics who graduates just when the Second World War is beginning, and therefore he goes into the army, etc., intelligence, and he's sent to Cadiz because he speaks Spanish, having been brought up abroad. So he's in Cadiz for his first mission. And I spent many years living in Cadiz, which is actually why I chose it for my first setting. The second book is called Washington Shadow and will be due out this November.
Thank you. Matt?
I'm the author of a series of books featuring a character called Joe Hunter. You know, over 2 hunters on the panel here. My character's a ex-counterterrorism agent who's now retired, who's working as a freelance security consultant, but sometimes termed as a vigilante. He's the kind of guy who's driven to help other people in need. A bit of an update of the old idea of the Equalizer show, you know, that was a little bit of an influence on me in my time. More of an action thriller approach than a whodunit. You know, it's a lot of my influences came from the Pulp Fiction era, so I like action-driven stories. I'm also a fan of 1970s men's fiction as well, like the MacBall and the Executioner, all those kind of things. So it's about the action, it's about the thrill, as opposed to the whodunit aspect. So coming from that angle.
Okay, thank you, Jenny.
Well, my name's Jenny Mills, and I feel a little bit of a cheat on this panel, actually, because my first novel came out 2 years ago. So, in fact, my second novel's almost about to come out. But my first one was called Crowstone, and it was set in Bath, so not very far from here, because I actually live in the southwest. And it's set underground, mostly, as those of you who've been to the Psychological Thrillers panel will remember. It's the story of a woman who is a mining engineer who goes back to prop up some very unstable ancient stone mines under the city of Bath. and becomes convinced that there is an interesting archaeological secret in there. Meanwhile, of course, she has her own secret from her own past, and the book uncovers both the archaeological secret and the secret of why Kit, actually for a mining engineer, is remarkably uncomfortable underground. And that's really what it's about.
Okay, thank you very much. You will all now be tested on that. I think my first question, and I can guess the answer from Matt and Matthew, we'll ask them anyway, is why crime fiction? Why did you move into that genre? Is it because of your background, Matthew?
Yeah, many years ago I was a criminal lawyer. Not a career I enjoyed very much, but I then turned to screenwriting, and obviously I drew on my experience in the law, so I ended up writing a lot of legal drama, a lot of detective drama. And so I just got in the way of formulating crime stories, I suppose. And then it's interesting because I'm not sure that my book strictly is in the crime genre, because the character is a coroner. So I see it slightly more as a legal thriller, because she is carrying out a sort of super judicial function. There are elements of crime in it, but it's far closer, I think, to the sort of well-established American genre of the legal thriller.
Yeah. We can accommodate that within crime.
Okay.
we can do that. What about you, Matt? I mean, ex-policeman, I guess that gives it away.
Yeah, ex-policeman, ex-security for 22 years, but I came, like I just said a moment ago, I came into it via a different angle. I came from fancy horror genres early on, like Lovecraft and Poe and Robert E. Howard. I actually outgrew those and started looking at something a little bit, you know, deeper, and crime drew me for the same kind of darkness, the plots and the action elements as well.
Yeah.
So I came into it via that angle.
Okay.
You know, I don't know much about Parker or Hammett or anybody like that, you know, but
you have some treats in store then.
Yeah.
Alison, you already had an interest in rather gruesome true crimes.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I suppose lots of people would say they're writing what they like to read. So the question is, why do I like to read crime in the first place? And I grew up in quite a large family, and from an early age it was quite evident that there were lots of skeletons in the closets, and nobody kind of talked. I'm not going to talk about them either. I became the one in the family that was trying to piece together all the bits of bones and make a whole skeleton. So that's how I got interested in kind of what makes people tick and what's going on behind the scenes. So,
and what was it that made you move from kind of true crime to fictional crime?
No, it was the other way around, actually.
Ah, was it?
Yeah,
okay,
I'd written the first Gary Goodhue book, and while I was waiting to rewrite it again, I suppose, I had the offer of doing a book about Cambridgeshire murders, which was part of a series of county crimes, and so I thought it would be a really good way to go from being not published to being published, which it was. I did that, and then there was an option for a second book, which I've also done. But
about a hangman?
Yes, yeah, Victorian Hangman, which comes out next month. But I think looking at real crime gives you some of the stories from true crime are probably more far-fetched than the things you might put in your own books, but it gives you a good background in trying to understand what really has motivated people to commit crimes before. So I think it's all good practice.
Right. What about you, Ali?
Well, I think mine probably came from two different places. One of them is that as I was growing older, like we all do perhaps, we tend to listen quite a lot, a little bit more to our parents' generation. And when my children were growing up and became a particular age, I became quite curious that our parents' generation, who had been responsible for the war and fighting the war and the dismantling of the empire and so on, had been incredibly young, you know. I mean, a 25-year-old today is probably very often living with mum and dad. And at this age, they were responsible for huge things and put in situations for example, the Second World War was like a huge happenstance which changed people's lives, you know. People did things, and if they survived the war, then that changed their life forever. So I was very interested in what made these people become what they were, you know. And I had a lot of people in my family who were involved in the colonies and the war, etc. And so I listened to their stories a lot. And this figure of the young graduate who is in the army, etc., going into espionage and put in situations that he really doesn't know much about. And it's like, find out what you have to do and find the way of doing it. So I had this idea of taking him to different countries around the world during this post-war period when the whole world was changing and being carved up in different ways and the colonies were being dismantled, and literally putting him down in a slice of a time and a place and making the reader experience that time and place with him. So in a way, you could say that in each of the books of the series, the main protagonist is that particular time and place, and he's there as a kind of witness that takes us down in there with him as he works out what the hell is going on and what the hell am I supposed to do and how am I supposed to do it and who can I trust. And that brings me to the second, very quickly, reason that, having lived in Spain for a long time and first went there at the end of the Franco dictatorship, I was very much aware that they were living in a world which was an environment which was completely oppressed, and nobody could actually say what they really thought, you know? So everybody spoke in a kind of shrouded language, and you had to try to work out what the hell people were saying, you know? Very quickly, I had a friend who had a baby. This was right at the end of the Franco era. And she went to the gynecologist after she'd had the baby, and the baby and the gynecologist said, right, you're great, you're doing well, etc. So she said, well, how about some contraception now, because I don't really want another baby now. And he said, I can't do that. You know very well it's against the law. And all I can do is help you get better and help you look after your child well. So don't even say we've had this conversation, because it's illegal. Right? So she said, okay, all right, thinking I'll have to send to England and see what I can do. And then at the end, he said, well, look, by the way, take these pills because they'll actually help you to recover and do well and all the rest of it. And so when she got home, she read the little leaflet that comes inside. And right at the bottom, there was a little warning. And it said, do not take if you are trying to become pregnant because there is a danger that you may not conceive. So that was the answer, right? You had to actually read behind what everyone said. And this business of trying to discover what people say is actually part of the maze of Cadiz. He's trying to, he gets dead ends, he's trying to filter the information and analyse and work out where he's going.
Okay, thank you. Jenny?
Well, I didn't really set out to write a crime novel at all, but I think the thing was that when I was growing up, my dad used to read Ed McBain and lots of police procedurals, and my mum used to read Daphne du Maurier and lots of those kind of slightly historical mysteries and thrillers in that sort. And so when I came to write anything, it didn't seem like a book if it didn't have a body in it. And that really, I suppose, was how I ended up writing a crime novel, because it wasn't supposed to be, but inevitably. And, you know, the body doesn't turn up until quite a long way through it, but it is there in the end.
Yeah, but without a body, we can't imagine that, yeah. Steve, what about you?
Well, as Alison said, you know, a lot of us do tend to write what we like to read, and that's very much where I've come from. And in common with one of the panels I was watching yesterday, it all started for me with Enid Blyton. And I know that raised a laugh on the other panel as well. But it honestly did. I mean, my mum, she had all the Famous Five and Secret Seven books as a child in hardback, and she kept them, and they were pretty much the first things I read. And of course, the thing about them is they are sort of mysteries. And so the very first things I read were mystery type books. And then from there, I became a regular down the local library and reading the likes of Harry Queen mysteries and Agatha Christie as I sort of went on. And as I then hit my teens, I started to broaden out into American crime fiction, and that's sort of where I stopped. And probably about 80-90% of what I read is US set crime fiction. And that's where I've drawn my inspiration from. They're the sort of books I love. Particularly, I mean, don't get me wrong, I read a lot of police procedurals, I enjoy a lot of police procedurals, but I like the characters that are slightly outside the law and slightly more shade of grey rather than black and white morally. You know, you, on the whole, they do things that you agree with, but sometimes you take a step back and think, well, do I really buy into it, or do I accept what this character is doing morally? So that's where my whole sort of inspiration has come from just through my life, really, as a reader, first and foremost. So when it came to writing a book, it was just completely natural to me that that's the sort of book I wanted to write, a US-based crime book. And I get asked quite a lot, you know, would you ever set a book in the UK, or why don't you write books in the UK? I'm honestly not sure I could. I'd have to try and see, but I'm so immersed in US crime fiction, and also, of course, TV and film. So there's a lot of influence there for me as well. But that's what excites me, and that's what drives me to write, and, you know, gets me up in the morning and makes me sit in a room on my own for 6-7 hours a day trying to draw a story out. It's the love of US crime fiction, so that's why I started writing in the genre.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned morality then. I wonder what you all thought about morality in relation to crime fiction. Matthew, morality and the law aren't necessarily the same thing. I don't know what your take on morality in crime fiction is.
Well, when I was a criminal lawyer, I was a criminal barrister for a few years, and I had to prosecute and defend. And with all due respect to my colleague here, who was a policeman, I ended up not liking the police very much at all. When they all got together and wrote the same thing in their notebooks and pretended that they all had their individual recollections.
The ones you met, you mean, of course, not everybody.
Well, I met them quite often. Anyway, I sort of got quite a jaded view of the justice system. I ended up feeling that we're all sort of potentially criminal. And from a reading perspective, I'm far more interested in reading writers like Elmore Leonard, who writes crime fiction, but he writes from the perspective of the criminals. They interest me, that motivation and the shades of grey. So I do not buy into the clean-cut investigating detective, because I think that really is a total fantasy.
Yeah. Matt, we better.
I agree in a lot of cases. The morality issue, obviously I'm coming from a police background, but I'm writing about somebody who's kind of vigilante, so it's it sounds a bit strange. However, he's still a man of honour and a man driven by a sense of justice. Albeit it's maybe not the law of the land, he sees it as being like an honourable law. It goes, it's more like your samurai ethics or your knight errant ethics. It's that kind of thing, whereby he'll stand up and if there's someone who's if you want a basic term, bullying someone else, he's the one who'll step between them and stop the bully from bullying the other one. And I think that reflects me in a lot of respects as well. I've always been I'm not a violent person, I don't advocate violence in any shape or form, but I was the one who'd stick up for the little kid in the playground who was being bullied by others, you know, and I think that carried through into my writing, and morally that's how I set myself. I don't like to see injustice, I don't like to see people being put on, whatever shape, form, race, creed or colour, and that's where I come from, and that's what I base my character upon as well. He does violent things, but only to violent people, if that makes sense. He would never ever, harm an innocent or God forbid, a child or a lady or anything like that.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit old-fashioned morals, but, I think that's the way I was brought up, give up your seat on the bus for someone who's carrying shopping or something, open doors. Some people see it as a little jaded now and, apologise, but that's the way I was brought up, and that carries through into my character as well.
Yeah. Alison, is your policeman moral?
Yeah, he is. He's actually spent a lot of time watching old movies, so he's got this very sort of film noir-y style of right and wrong, and so there is a big black and white element to him, but his idea of black and white isn't necessarily the same as everybody else's idea of black and white all the time. So it's going to be, interesting to explore where he goes with where the overlap is entirely the other way. So if he thinks something's black and, society says it's white, and he does stick to his own moral code, and sometimes that's a difficult thing to do when you're being pulled in the opposite direction, and it's those decisions that I think define him. and I don't actually think there's... It could make a character boring to have them quite black and white, but equally it can mean that they have to be quite a strong personality, and that's where Good Hugh is. He's a strong personality.
Okay, Jenny, what about you? Does morality impinge?
I suppose it does. I mean, the perpetrator of the crime in my novel is brought to justice, but I think what I was quite interested in was the sense of dissatisfaction that everybody feels afterwards. Although morality has been served and somebody has been sent to prison, you don't actually feel that it necessarily solved anything. But at the same time, I still think that you need a sense of redemption at the end of a novel. And there is a sense of redemption, but it's not completely satisfying. Because I think life's like that, and I would find it very hard to write a novel that was simply, you know, the baddie did it, gets caught, and goes to prison, and everybody lives happily ever after, because in my experience, that might happen, but nobody lives happily ever after, you know, because that's what crime does. Crime completely explodes lives.
What about you, Ali?
Well, I'm just listening to Jenny there, and I mean, I agree entirely that things are not black and white and people are not good and bad. And I think that one of the things that really interests me in it is how we're all capable of doing things that we probably don't imagine that we are. And it not until you are put into a particular situation, in a particular environment, do you actually know how you're going to react to it. And I would never say I would never do that, because I don't know. That's really one of the horrible things. None of us know, if we're honest, how we would react put into unknown circumstances with unknown pressures on us. We just don't know. And that's one of the things that interests me, how an environment acts on a character and how you make the choices you make and how you're affected by those choices you do make. So, yes, I'm interested in the morality, but morality isn't an entity which exists on its own. It's something which is constantly in interaction with what's going on around you and the people that are around you as well. And so, yes, it's the forming of people again and how they develop, and that's really what interests me about it.
Yeah, and this idea of reality not having things tied up in the way that happens in fiction. I mean, Steve, was that an issue for you in terms of trying to be realistic, perhaps in terms of how explicit you felt you needed to be? Or
Yeah, and I'd like to pick up as well on something Matthew said about... Elmore Leonard, and how he enjoys Leonard's books because you see things from the view of the criminal. And I think that's vital. Personally, I mean, I tend to write multi-viewpoint novels where one of the lead characters will be, for want of a better word, the bad guy. So you get to see why he's behaving as he is. And no one is inherently evil, pretty much. And there are some of their influences, and as Ali was saying, and the environment around them. And that's, you know, we need to understand and make them a more rounded character, I think, for the reader, to show why they're behaving as they are. And probably a good example is in my second novel about to come out in July called Blood Law. One of the characters I follow is a drug dealer. So the first thing you think, and he's an inner city LA drug dealer, and obviously on paper he's not a nice person. He's selling drugs to kids and trying to make a living off that. But then when you get inside his head and you find that his father was never there and was sent down on a life sentence when he was very young. His mother was a heroin addict from he was sort of the age of five, and he was helping her to fix up. He had no education, no money, no job prospects, jumped into a street gang at the age of 10, and he can see no way out and doesn't even have the ability to see a way out of the situation he's in. And then you start to not necessarily sympathise with him, but you can empathise with him and you can understand why he does what he does. And I think that's an important element of a crime novel, is to not just show it from the hero viewpoint solving all the problems, but also show the problems and why they're occurring in society, in fact. And often it is a society issue, and it's rich versus poor and opportunity versus non-opportunity.
Would you agree with that, Alison?
Yeah, I do, actually. I was just thinking about this business of black and white. If somebody has black and white opinions, it doesn't mean it's they might feel they follow a moral code. It doesn't mean that other people perceive them as following a moral code, does it? So probably in the case of this drug dealer, he probably does have what he thinks is a black and white sense of what he thinks is on one side of the line and what is on the other, but it would be entirely different to a lot of other people's. And that's the big dilemma, isn't it? That sort of weighing up what pushes people to move that line and step over the line and change where they think the line lies.
Matt, you said that your main character has got his own morality, but I mean, do you look at the viewpoint of the criminals with any sympathy?
Yes, and the point here, just to reiterate what was said there, to the villains, he'll be the villain. So, you know, it's all about a matter of perspective, you know. So it's the same when I was a police officer to the villains, if you want to call them that. I was the bad guy because I was the one who was stopping them from pursuing their...
And to the lawyers, of course,
But you understand, it's all a matter of a viewpoint and principle, and what some people see as being okay and acceptable, others don't, you know. So that's the way I come at it, yeah. So a couple of times in my books, the bad guy actually thinks that he's the righteous person, and he's the one that's following his bent or his trade, and Joe Hunter's the actual person who's stopping him from achieving his aims. So it's true for real life as well, with the viewpoint.
Okay. I mean, going back to the realism question, I mean, Matthew, how realistic do you think your books are, or can conceivably be?
Good point. I bend reality a little bit, but only for the purposes of making the story dramatically satisfying. So the central character is a coroner, and she does a lot of what coroners can do, but she does do a little bit more, because you need that in the fictional world. You do it in television as well, it happens all the time. So she's no more unlike a real coroner than, say, the characters in The Bill are different from real policemen.
Yeah.
So I do try and weld it to reality.
Yeah. And presumably for you, Ali, it's important to get that time and place as accurate as you can, or are you inventing your own time and place, really?
No, I am actually trying to be authentic about the time and place, definitely. I think for the Maze of Cadiz, it was relatively easy to do for me, although I still had to do a lot of research. But since I'd knew Spain at the very end of the Franco era, and lots of people from the whole spectrum of society, from the homeless to the butcher to doctors, lawyers, etc., politicians spoke to you because you were foreign. So you got an idea of what Franco Spain was like, because it didn't change very much in 40 years, believe me. A lot of it was the same. So I could actually put in a lot of authenticity. And the actual place of Cadiz, which is very small, is like a maze of streets. And so it's real and metaphorical at the same time, if you like. And that had changed some from 1944, and I made sure that I got everything right, and that if a building had changed or wasn't there anymore, etc., that I had that well documented. But an awful lot of it was the same. So I suppose for me it was a little bit of a nostalgic journey as well, doing that part of the book. But also also for me it was a bit of a tribute to the people who had, been really ripped apart by the Civil War and were trying to get on with life in a decent way, whatever their political... Because they're victims. You're victims of a political label when you're living in a democracy. You can't actually speak out and say what you want. And underneath that surface, they're quite human people, And I suppose I wanted it to be a little bit of a tribute to that as well.
Yeah. Jenny, you and realism?
Well, you see, I used to be a journalist, so I think that background detail is important. But obviously, as Matthew was saying, you have to sort of bend that to fit what the book needs, because it is, after all, it's a story, it's a fiction. And I mean, I do quite a lot of research. In the second book that I've been doing, it's partly set in the 1930s at Avebury, and so I've done a lot of research into, which you can do quite easily, into the history of the place and what it was like. But then there are more nebulous things that you've got to convince yourself and the reader that you know something about. And where I had a real problem with that was I very stupidly said to my publisher, as you often do, oh, I'm going to write this novel, and she said, what's it about? And I said, oh, it'll be set in a haunted landscape, and it will be, you know, about the 1930s, and there'll be some ritual sex magic in there. And as soon as I said that, I thought, I really regret saying that, because I know, to pardon my French, sod all about ritual sex magic.
Oh.
And I used to go round, as you do as an author, to library, giving talks to people in libraries, and I'd always sort of say, and I'm writing this novel and it's got ritual sex magic in it, and I really wish I'd never said that, because actually I just don't. And always, you know, in these obscure places like Warminster, which is a very strange place, somebody would always come up to you afterwards and say, did you say you wanted to know something about ritual sex magic? So yeah, I could have known a lot more about it than I actually do, but I I decided that you have to draw a line somewhere, I think, with realism.
Okay. We'll see what happens at the end of this session, who comes forward. You're all beyond your first novels now, but I wonder if you can remember when you were writing these first novels, whether you were writing for a particular readership or what, whether you were being quite ruthless about the kind of novel you wanted to write to get published. Alison?
It was the story that came first. I was on the way to work one day and I thought, I've come up with a new way of killing people that I've never read before.
There speaks a crime writer.
And I thought about this for a few days, and I felt so strongly about it that I thought, it's worth writing a book. And so obviously I didn't know what I was doing at all, and I thought, you know, I've read loads, it must be easy. And so I eventually produced this book, and it came out of this one thought, really.
About a new way to murder someone.
Yeah.
It's very worrying indeed. Steve, what about you?
I was writing for a very, very specific readership when I first started writing, and that was me. Simple as that. Yeah, I dreamt of getting published, and I wanted to be published, but my very first goal was to start, write, and finish a novel. And I knew if I did that, I'd have a real sense of achievement, and I'd consider, you know, at the end of my life, I can point to that dusty old manuscript in the corner and say, yeah, I wrote that. My next goal was, hopefully I'll like that novel. And then if I can find one other person. So that was sort of where I started. It wasn't like a grand plan of, oh, if I write an American set thriller, there's a big market for that. I mean, I was aware of these realities, of course, but that was never the goal. The goal was to write a novel for the joy of writing novels. I think, in all honesty, anyone who sets out thinking, I'm doing this, I'm going to get published, chances are you're in for a disappointment, because... Yeah. Now, we're very lucky to be sat on this stage and to have publishing deals, because the vast majority of people never make it.
Yeah, that's true. Matthew?
I was writing for myself. Actually, what happened, I'd conceived of this character. I'd had her for a number of years in my mind, and I thought about it for television originally. But then I thought, actually, there's a dark side of this character I want to deal with, which is her... She suffers very badly from anxiety disorder. She even gets suicidal at one point in the book. That would be completely unacceptable for television. So I thought, well, actually, what I'm going to do is forget about all of that. I'm just going to write a book and write the character that really interests me. So I suppose I was writing it for myself, but mining a theme that I really wanted to get at. It was a bit of sort of psychoanalysis of myself, I suppose. So I wasn't aiming for any particular audience, and so I think something quite personal came out in the end.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Ali?
Well, first of all, I don't think I really ever set out to be a writer. It's something that kind of, you know, evolved. I moved back from Spain and stopped my teaching job, although I was still translating, and so I had a lot of free time, and voices and things that I'd heard, which I could sort of store up in your head, things that people have said, began to develop, and I began to develop this character, which was really Ramirez, who's the local police chief who has an alliance with Cotton. And this grew into something, and then I said to myself one night, God, you like writing around at nights, and you're thinking about this person, he's growing into something, so do something about it. And then it was after that I began to put it together, and I thought, hang on, this could make a series, and I put it together with the other ideas I'd had about that I've told you before about the young man, what makes the war, etc. And then I thought, it can make a series, and to sell it, publishers like things with legs. So I thought, let's give it some legs, and that's really what happens.
Okay, give it some legs. What about you, Matt?
Exact same idea as what's been mentioned there. I was writing since I was a small child, and primarily for myself, and just for the enjoyment of it. Over the years, I started getting that dream of, I want to be a published author. And since I was approximately 20 years old, up to my late 30s, I was writing standalone books with no legs, basically. They had no commercial value, I guess. I was sending them off, and I was being, you know, I was getting nice feedback saying, yeah, good story, but, you know, it doesn't quite fit our brief, or, but keep it up, you're doing okay, you know. So I kind of felt that I had what it took to write some books, but then I realised that what I needed to do was find a serious character who I could develop and carry through a series of books, which is why I came up with this Joe Hunter character. I gave him the skills and the necessary tools and the background to be able to get into these, you know, action adventure situations on a frequent basis. So that's where I came from. So I did write Dead Man's Dust with the idea of a serious character with a commercial aspect.
Right.
You know.
Right. And Jenny?
Well, like everybody else, I mean, I definitely write, first of all, with me and people like me, I suppose, in mind when I'm writing, because I think it's impossible to write any other way. If you were simply writing with the view to, let's be cynical and get published, it just wouldn't work. But on the other hand, I had decided, I'd made a very, very conscious decision that having been writing for quite a long part of my adult life and never really doing anything very much with it, that in fact it was about time to get serious. And I did something that a lot of people do. I went on a creative writing MA. So Crowstone, in a very bizarre way, was written for me, but it was also written for an awful lot of my tutors who were going to be marking the damn thing, because my mother had lent me the money to do the creative writing MA, and she'd always been really disappointed in how I'd done when I did my first degree at university. She said, "Oh, I do hope you'll get a distinction." So I had to work really, really hard and write Crowstone so that all my tutors would give me good marks. And then at the end of the course, I had to take it back and rewrite it again. Because actually, if you write a book just in order to get good marks, it's not going to have a life of its own. So it got rewritten again for me, and I think probably it wouldn't have got published otherwise.
So writing primarily to impress your mum, as far as I understand that.
She was very shocked, by the way, when she read the book. She said, "Oh, that's interesting, but your heroine ought to wash her mouth out, I think."
I mean, Matthew said that his book ended up being quite a personal book, and of course first novels are historically pretty autobiographical. Alison, is this book about you, really?
The first book I wrote, yeah. It stemmed from a very bad early relationship I had. I was engaged to somebody who turned out to be a bit of a nutter, and of course he dumped me before I dumped him, and I spent quite a few months afterwards kind of wondering how that had come about. And then he actually went on to go out with a series of women, and we all looked the same, and it was all quite creepy. We were just this. I actually saw a woman in the supermarket, and I thought, that's me. And I stood there, and then a second later he joined her, and I thought, that's really weird. And I sort of extrapolated his behaviour, and I extrapolated my behaviour, and so I ended up with one character who's quite traumatised after a breakdown of relationship with a bloke that turns out to be a complete nutter. So, yes, it was.
And Matt, you've kind of indicated that your character's got your moral attitudes, but is he kind of your ideal alter ego?
He's a fit version of me, yeah. I'm more handsome. Yeah, obviously it's my ideal, you know, it's my alter ego. As a police officer, very, very constrained by rules, regulations, bureaucracy. It was probably my dark side, you know, thinking if the you know, if the rules weren't there and if I wasn't wearing a uniform, things would probably be a little different. So in that respect, yes.
Yeah. What about you, Ali? Is yours a form of autobiography, your first novel?
I think probably no. Or no, it isn't. Although I think you can't really avoid putting yourself into whatever you write. You know, your attitudes are going to come through in some way. But I did actually make a conscious decision when I thought, okay, if you are actually deciding to write a book, don't write a girly book, because I you know, have a horror of writing a girly book. I didn't want to. And I thought, take on something which, you know, is traditionally a male sphere and do it. And then, of course, I realised that all other women are doing exactly the same thing. But, so no, he's not. And also, I think writing about somebody who's totally different from myself doesn't mean that there aren't certain attitudes or even moral approaches which he might have in common with me. But it gives me a freedom. You know, I'm sure you've all known actors who are desperately, cripplingly shy, but put them on the stage and they're there, you know? And I find that doing something about somebody who's entirely different from me really gives me more freedom and I can do it better.
Yeah.
It may be weird, but it's the way it is.
It works, yeah. Yes. Steve, yours isn't really a girly book, so, but are you secretly American?
I guess, yeah, to a point. I guess there's certainly elements, a fair few elements of myself in my lead character. And as Matt says, you know, he's the sort of better looking, in better shape and version of me, and probably more importantly than anything else, he's the guy that says the stuff straight away when you need to say it, rather than I'm the guy half an hour later thinking, wish I would have said that at that point, that would have been very clever, funny, and I'll probably be thinking this about this panel in about half an hour's time. So yeah, there's certainly elements, and particularly with Justice for All, that came from a very singular thought I had in my mind, which ties in to an extent with something Matthew was saying earlier, about justice and about how you almost feel powerless a lot of the time when you read the press and you hear, you know, either no one's been caught or someone's been caught and they're going to get away with it through technicalities, or at best they've been caught, they've been punished, but it's a 3-month sentence for something you figure should be 10 years. You know, it just doesn't seem to quite tally up with what I believe would be a reasonable punishment, if you like. So I came with a viewpoint with Justice for All of how do criminal defence lawyers defend the indefensible when they must know some of the time, I guess, with their clients that they're guilty as hell of horrible things, but their job is to get up and do their level best to keep them out of prison. And the whole sort of book just came from this one thought, you know, based around that subject.
Yeah, we'll maybe come back to that, so Matthew can talk about that. But Jenny, do you want your mum to realise how much of your book is about you?
Well, no. I mean, you see, I set out to write a book that was very definitely not about me, and it was a bit of a shock when at the end of it all my friends said, well, it's you, isn't it? Except she's thinner. A lot thinner. And that was very annoying. And it's true, actually, there are a lot of, I think probably like every author, there are a lot of my issues somewhere in the book, though I'd deliberately chosen the character who was doing something very different from the kind of job I did and was a lot more sort of roughy-tufty and tomboyish and immoral in some ways than I am, I hope. But no, I mean, interesting, there is a part of the book that is, the father in the book is based very, very loosely on my own father, who had a very, very violent temper. Although he wasn't abusive as the father in the book is, but he did have a dreadful temper, and I was very worried that both my mother, while she was still alive, and more importantly my brother, would realise that and would be quite upset by it. But neither of them, I think, ever felt that that was my father in the book, whereas to me it definitely is. And it's quite interesting. I hope my brother never hears me say this, by the way.
This is being recorded, you realise that? Matthew, just quickly, can you just maybe comment on what Steve said about lawyers and ambiguity?
Yeah, well, I mean, the answer is simply that as a defence lawyer, you're not thinking about the morality, you're thinking purely about the evidence. So it's a bit like a surgeon doesn't consider the morality of the person he's operating on. When you're in the courtroom, it's purely a question of dissecting the prosecution evidence. Have they got enough to prove this particular point you don't have time, really, to think about the morality of what's going on. And also you have a generalised morality that the system is a good system, so you're helping to uphold the whole system. Afterwards, of course, you go away and reflect on it, but not at the time.
Okay. Questions from the audience there. Sorry, I overran a little bit. So questions from the audience. If you've got one, stick your hand in the air. The best question wins a spot prize, I believe. At the back there, then there, and then there. Is there one thing that when your novel was completed that, and when it was being published, as I understand it, that made you think differently about yourself as a writer?
I'm not sure about differently. There is that massive sense of achievement, and particularly when one of the first things actually was seeing the cover. You know, there's the cover of my book. There was an email came through saying, here's what we think is going to be the cover. And I went to open it, and I just paused, and I thought, oh, what if I don't like it? Because there's no chance of me being able to change it in any way. So I was really worried. And then, of course, you open it, and I loved it, and it was great. But the one thing, I guess, that your perception, if you like, changes slightly, is you've got this whole desire to be published, and it takes a bit of slog to get there and a bit of luck and everything else along the way. And then you sort of figure, or I certainly did, and having had conversations with other authors around here, I think it's quite common, you think once you're published, you've made it. No, you haven't. Because you've got to sell some books, and you know, so you've just got this whole, the goalposts just suddenly move, and you've got a whole new challenge ahead of you, and that's the thing that changed for me.
Okay, just a couple more answers, Matt.
Yeah, I was going to say very much the same to that. As a writer, it's very personal. You're sitting in front of a computer or a book, and it's very much in your own head, and you know, a lot of the time spent on your own. You want to be, you know, a published writer and out there and people reading and enjoying your books, but to do that you have to publicise those books. For me, I'm a kind of shy, retiring person, really. I know, and you know, sometimes I maybe put it on a little bit, but I'm quite shy and I don't push myself forward very much, and I've actually had to learn how to actually do that, and that's the biggest shock or the biggest impact on my life that I've actually found since you're a published writer now, you know, and that's the biggest impact. It's changed my whole outlook on the actual industry in a good way, though.
Yeah. What about you, Matthew? I mean, given that you're already successful as a scriptwriter, but that's kind of behind the scenes in a way.
Yeah, I know. I think you feel like I felt like a proper writer for the first time in 10 or 12 years, I suppose. That was the main thing. Yeah, you write TV scripts and your name flashes up quickly and no one knows it. So it felt, you know, I'll be honest, it felt wonderful to have a published book.
Great, okay, I'll get you three to answer the next question, which is from you.
I have a question to ask you. In a practical sense, right now, you've all been successful, you at least have a publication in place. Most of you have talked about the grayness of life rather than black and white. Have you seen, or do you expect to see, any change in UK law that is going to be sensitive to what you think is the reality of life, is that there is no black and white, that we are all sort of, we can do it or not do it?
Wow. Alison.
Why me?
Glad I answered the last question.
I like the UK law bit.
Yeah.
UK law.
Get the US off.
Right, exactly.
I think we're going to see. I've got a thing, a bit bee in my bonnet at the moment about, because my children are 9 and 3, about future. You know, before I had the children, you only look ahead a few years,
yeah.
And now you look ahead to maybe the time when they're my age and think, how are they going to feel when their children are their age? And so I think that we're going to see a lot of things that affect. Things to do with the environment, things to do with the longevity of our planet, and I think they're going to have to be brought in through law rather than you know, through legislation rather than through people having the goodwill of wanting to, you know, consume less and behave better. And I think some of those things will then lead to dissatisfaction, because it's very hard to take things away from people once they've been used to, you know, freely spend and waste and consume. So I think that there'll be changes there. And I also think that there's a huge problem with we have a prison system that's packed to exploding. And so it means that it's very hard to keep handing out what you think might be fair sentences when there's not enough place to put prisoners. And I personally think that until those sort of things are dealt with at a more fundamental level, and people are given, prisoners are given better opportunities to rehabilitate, and people are given better opportunities not to commit crime in the first place, you know, there's better education. And I think what we're going to see is there's going to have to be a tipping point when, as a nation, we take greater social responsibility. And I think we'll see some of those things feeding through into law, which I hope is the case.
See, Annie, I was right to ask you first. Jenny, what do you think?
Well, I was thinking, why didn't I get asked the other question? But I think there's going to be a huge change in law that is going to impact on the kind of fiction we write. And I think that that's going to be to do with us all feeling very much more watched in the future and very much more documented. And I mean, I suspect, although I don't very much like the idea, that we are going to find that we're all carrying ID cards before long. And I already feel very much, you know, when I get in my car and I drive along the motorway, and all the way along the motorway, somebody knows where I'm going. And I think that's going to have a huge impact on our lives, but it will also have a huge impact on the kind of fiction that we write, because actually, you know, you're going to have to write fiction where people do manage to drop out and disappear behind the scenes, because
going
otherwise...
underground,
yeah, going underground. Yeah, it's my obsession, isn't it?
Ali, it's probably not appropriate to you, but do you have a comment, or do you want to lead on the next question?
I'll have a brief comment about it. Yes, I mean, I think Alison already touched on a point that one of the biggest changes, of course, for our children, my children are a lot older than yours, but is going to be an economic one. I mean, we're just not going to be able to live in the way that we have been living. But from the point of view of the grey areas, I think that what I hope, and I don't know if it's going to happen, but what I do hope is that somehow something is going to be done about the vast and increasing numbers of children and then adults who have had no education and therefore no equipment, no emotional, intellectual equipment to be able to handle life in any kind of way. And therefore, a lot of the so-called baddies who are ending up in prison with no possible future are really there because they do not have the resources in themselves to be able to cope with life. And I feel very strongly about this, and I'm going to stop talking about it, or I shall bore everyone to death. But I do think that it's actually the fundamental thing.
Okay. Thank you for that. No question here. Yeah.
I'm glad you answered that, because my question is actually for Matthew. In my experience, it's quite unusual for a male crime fiction author to have a female protagonist. And in your case, you did it. In my reading experience, unnervingly well. You not only got into the woman's real emotions in a very good way, but also you described what it's actually like for a professional woman. Who's worked for many years, and what it's actually like for her to experience all the mini prejudices and patronising attitudes that she had to overcome. Could you just explain why you chose that and achieved that insight?
I can't explain exactly how I came up with a woman. The character originally was male, and then was just a day on which the character suddenly became female and then came to life. There are two reasons. I wanted to give her this anxiety disorder. It's really quite acute anxiety disorder that she's struggling with, something which I had personal experience. And I thought, if I put that into a male character, we won't sympathise with him, but somehow we will sympathise with the female character suffering in that way. And the other reason is, I suppose, I've just been surrounded by women for the last 20 years. I've been married an awful long time. A lot of my colleagues at work were female. The whole television industry is dominated by women, strangely. So I knew far more, I felt I knew a lot about women's dilemmas, I suppose.
Just briefly, or each of the others very briefly, because we're almost out of time, writing the opposite sex, easy or difficult, Jenny?
I think it's a challenge. And I mean, in fact, my novels are narrated in the first person by a woman, but I wouldn't rule out the idea of writing as a man. I think that would be fascinating.
Matt, as a woman?
One book I wrote was with a female lead, wasn't published. There you go.
Love said, thank you, Ali. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I've spent a long time of my life trying to teach my daughters that there's no difference between men and women. And, you know, in Spain, they used to send their daughters to school with pink ribbons in their hair. And I sent mine as plainly dressed as possible and said, make the words count, you know, this kind of thing. And so I've tried to approach that by having a male protagonist.
Sure.
That's the answer.
Yeah. Steve?
I'd hate to say it was easy to write female characters. It's not easy to write full stop. But because I write multi-viewpoint novels, I always have at least one female character in there. And I enjoy writing from that different perspective, and I think I hope it enhances the books, that you see what's happening, you see the plot, and you just get this different perspective on it from a woman's viewpoint. I hope I do it well. I guess it remains to be seen what the audience thinks.
What about you, Alison?
I've got the same multi-viewpoint thing going on, but as a protagonist, obviously good choose male, but I would say fairly sensitive in some ways. I could see myself writing a female protagonist, but she'd probably be a strong woman. I can't imagine myself writing a girly girl or too much of a macho bloke.
Okay, that's a perfect place to end, and then we have to do. Thank you all for coming. Our authors will be signing copies of their books immediately next door. I think they all acquitted themselves very well. I look forward to reading further of their adventures. Please thank our guests.